This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the House opened hearings on the new Homeland Security Department proposed by President Bush. Congressional intelligence committees are currently investigating intelligence failures that preceded September 11th. My guest, Locke Johnson, is the author of Bombs, Bugs, Drugs, and Thugs, Intelligence and America's Quest for Security. He's a professor of public and international affairs at the University of Georgia. In 1995, he was the assistant to the chair of the Aspen-Brown Commission, which assessed U.S. intelligence in the wake of the Cold War. From 1977 to 79, he was staff director of a House Select Committee on Intelligence Oversight. And from 75 to 76, he was assistant to Frank Church on the Church Senate Committee that investigated CIA abuses in the wake of an investigation by New York Times reporter Seymour Hersh that revealed the CIA spied on Americans and helped overthrow the democratically elected Chilean president Salvador Allende. This was the first Congressional Intelligence Oversight Committee. I asked Johnson what it was like to hear intelligence secrets as they were revealed to the committee.
Well, it was quite stunning because, frankly, very few of us knew much about this subject because it had been so hidden for so long. And the senators and many of the staff were really boning up as quickly as they could. And we were meeting with people in the intelligence agencies to find out what had gone wrong. And then we developed a list of documents that we wanted to see that could help us understand some whether or not some of the allegations were true. So there was a long period here, about 5 or 6 months, in which we were frantically doing research and not really sleeping that much. We were, because we had time limits on how long the committee would last. So it was a rush of excitement, and it was considered very serious because the notion of these secret agencies, the CIA and several others, spying on American citizens was so Orwellian that was intolerable, if true. So we wanted to come to the bottom of matters. And as we looked into more and more of this, we found out that the initial horrors reported by Cy Hersh in the New York Times were only the beginning. And as we turned over the rocks, we found all kinds of other abuses that Hersh had not reported on, that none of the American people knew about, including assassination plots against foreign leaders and spying against American citizens, not just by the CIA, but a raft of other agencies.
Were you or other members of this Intelligence Oversight Committee ever afraid that you were asking the CIA to disclose too much information? And did any of the people in the CIA try to stop the investigation or limit the investigation, claiming that in the long run it would be harmful to U.S. intelligence and to U.S. security to have investigations like this?
Oh, yes, it was a constant struggle. There was stonewalling going on every day and all kinds of tricks used by the executive branch to delay what we were doing. For instance, once we had complained many weeks to the Pentagon about not giving us any documents that we wanted, and one afternoon a big army truck came over, a half-ton truck filled with documents, and it flooded our quarters with all these papers. So at first we were happy. And then as we waded through them, we realized that they were worthless. So there were lots of games played like that. And when it came to the assassination plots, Gerald Ford didn't want to go into that at all. And of course, Henry Kissinger, the Secretary of State, was adamant in refusing to appear in public hearings on the subject of covert action. And in a couple of instances, we actually had to go to Washington, D.C. District Court to get some of the documents we wanted. So it was a fight all the way.
And I'm just wondering what it felt like to you as a private citizen to suddenly have access to all this secret information.
Well, it was rather heady, and I must say, after a while, you don't feel like reading anything unless it's got stamped top secret on top of it. So it does get to be a little bit silly. And indeed, I'm told that in the bureaucracy, often people will stamp things top secret just so others will read it because nothing else gets read.
Mm-hmm. What were the most important precedents set by the Church Committee?
The most important thing the Church Committee did, and this would be true in the House too, where a committee run by Otis Pike did some similar work, was to establish permanent oversight committees, which had not existed before, for intelligence, so that in 1976 the Senate created the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and a year later the House created what's called the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. So now both of those chambers have members and staff who every day are looking at these 13 secret agencies and checking on their budgets and so on. It's not a perfect system by any means, as Iran-Contra points out, because even with this machinery in place, we still had the Iran-Contra scandal. But it's still the difference between night and day, pre-1975 and post-1975.
What are some of the things that Congress has created to keep intelligence agencies accountable to the public? And in talking about that, maybe you could talk, too, about the tension between accountability and just adding layers of bureaucracy that make intelligence work more difficult.
Yes. When it comes to looking at the question of legislative accountability over the executive branch, whether or not we're talking about the Department of Agriculture or these secret agencies, it comes down to constantly balancing security on the one hand and liberty on the other hand. By security, I mean protecting this country against threats like the one that happened on 9/11. And that means having efficient intelligence agencies that can move with dispatch and have some discretion and some flexibility. Yet flexibility and discretion, as we learned in 1975, can lead to the abuse of power. James Madison once said that power, lodged as it must be in human hands, is ever liable to abuse. And we certainly found that out again in 75. So that brings us to the other side of the scale, which is security, or rather liberty. And in order to have liberty, you've got to have the watchdogs, the checks and balances. And that may reduce efficiency to some degree because it means getting Congress involved and having hearings and so on. But you can't do without that in a democracy. So we're trying to find the appropriate balance between the two. You mentioned, Terry, what are some of the specific things that Congress does. I think two of the most important are establishing reporting requirements. And by that I mean, according to law, the CIA and other agencies must, on a periodic and routine basis, present to the Congress information about its ongoing activities, such as covert actions. Anytime the president signs a covert action authorization, that has to be reported to Congress. And then the second thing is hearings. It's constantly involved in holding hearings, usually secret or private hearings, because much of this information is sensitive, but hearings that help the legislators know what's going on.
One of the problems we appear to have run into is that the CIA and the FBI have kept information from each other. There's a lot of competition between the two agencies, a lot of rivalry. Is this a long-time problem?
Oh, it certainly is. You know, the FBI was created in 1908, so it's been around a long time, and it's a little cocky about his long lineage and in some ways feels superior over the newcomer agencies like the CIA, which was established in 1947. But on the other side of the ledger, the CIA feels somewhat superior because often the people out there have PhDs from lofty institutions and are somewhat smug in their intellectual abilities, whereas the FBI people are more inclined to be out on the streets trying to catch criminals. So there are some cultural differences here and some turf protection differences and competition over finite resources from the federal budget. At one point in the 1960s, the director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, refused even to speak to the director of Central Intelligence, Richard Helms. That probably was the lowest point in this relationship, but it's been rocky over the years.
What's the difference in what each agency can do domestically and internationally?
Traditionally, and by that I mean starting in 1947 in the case of the CIA, that agency was meant to look overseas. In fact, it was prohibited from activities within this country out of fear that it might turn into a Gestapo. And the FBI, in contrast, has had a long history of working within the United States, particularly catching bank robbers and white-collar criminals, but also doing some counterintelligence work, trying mainly to catch KGB and other Soviet agents in this country. So the CIA looks outward, the FBI inward, and when there's a spy overseas who travels from some foreign country to the United States, the CIA is supposed to hand off, if you will, that spy, and once he or she enters these borders, the FBI begins to follow that person. But it hasn't always worked. Now, sometimes it has. There are also some good examples where these two agencies work well together, but there are even more in which it hasn't worked smoothly. And sometimes it's personality. J. Edgar Hoover was a very difficult man to work with, very arrogant. And sometimes it's been some of these more organizational jealousies and pettiness that we've talked about.
Are there proposals on the table now to resolve this and to help coordinate information between the CIA and the FBI?
Not to the extent it should be, and that's why I find the new Department of Homeland Defense concept a little disappointing. I think it's a useful thing to do because some of those agencies plan to go into that new department, do need consolidation. But in a way, it misses the point, because the real point in the war against terrorism is to better coordinate the information among the existing 13 intelligence agencies, all of which will continue to lie outside this new Homeland Defense Department. And the way, in my view, and in many other people's views, to develop better coordination among the 13 agencies is to enhance the authority of the Director of Central Intelligence, who presently is a very weak figure. George Tenet, who holds that office presently, doesn't have budget or personnel authority over 12 of those agencies. He has that authority only over the Central Intelligence Agency, but the other dozen are quite independent and don't report as fully as they should to him. And it's because he doesn't have the kind of direct line authority over them.
What are the 13 intelligence agencies that collect information, the ones that we're hoping will coordinate a little bit better?
Well, I could probably bore you to death by going through all 13, but there are seven military intelligence agencies. The Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines all have intelligence units. There's the Defense Intelligence Agency. There's the National Security Agency. There's the National Reconnaissance Office. There's the Intelligence and Research Division of the State Department. The Energy Department has an intelligence unit that keeps track of fissionable and fusionable materials worldwide. The Treasury Department has some intelligence components. The FBI does, and the CIA, as we mentioned. So it's quite a cluster of agencies.
Clearly, the intelligence agencies fail to connect the dots, as everyone is saying. They fail to link certain pieces of information, which, if were linked, could have perhaps predicted what happened on September 11th. What do you think is one of the most compelling examples of something that could have been connected and wasn't and might have prevented September 11th?
Well, imagine if the FBI Phoenix memo talking about how maybe some people from other countries were in our country learning to fly airplanes. Imagine if that memo had not got lost in the bowels of the FBI and had been dealt with seriously there, but also, equally important, sent over to the CIA for their knowledge to see if they had any similar information. Or let's say the Minnesota FBI field office and its request to get a warrant to conduct surveillance against the person who's now often viewed as possibly the 20th hijacker, Mr. Moussaoui. What if that information had properly been handled in the FBI and, again, equally important, sent over to the CIA for cross-referencing? Very, very little of that was done, and those are just two of many examples. Harry Truman, back in 1947, when he created the CIA, wanted one thing above all else. He wanted all of these agencies to work together in one coordinated whole so that there would be genuine integration of information. After all, Pearl Harbor took us by surprise because there were fragments of information around, but none of it was really brought together properly and given to Franklin Roosevelt. So Truman wanted to make sure that didn't happen again, but unfortunately his dream has not been fulfilled.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Locke Johnson. He's a professor of public and international affairs at the University of Georgia in Athens. He's also the author of the book Bombs, Bugs, Drugs, and Thugs, Intelligence and America's Search for Security. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Locke Johnson is my guest. He's a professor at the University of Georgia at Athens. He's the author of Bombs, Bugs, Drugs, and Thugs, Intelligence and America's Search for Security. And in the mid-70s, he was the assistant to Frank Church on the Church Senate Committee that was probing CIA abuses. President Bush has proposed a new cabinet-level Department of Homeland Defense. What would the mission of this department be?
The mission of the proposed department is to overcome fragmentation within the government dealing with our border defense in particular, but some other aspects of protecting this country here at home. So it would bring together in one department the Coast Guard and the Federal Emergency Management Agency and 20 other entities, which would then comprise the new department. And they would presumably now working under the same roof, be able to cooperate better with one another. Of course, it's important to note that even though this is probably a useful thing to do, it leaves outside of the equation what I think are even more important agencies in the war against terrorism, agencies like the FBI and the CIA. And the real problem we face is getting those agencies to work better and to work in harness with one another more effectively. So the Homeland Defense idea is a piece of the puzzle that needs to be solved here, but only one piece. And there may be, in fact, I'm sure there are, even more important pieces of the puzzle that need attention but have not gotten it yet.
What's the rationale for leaving the FBI and the CIA out of this Department of Homeland Defense?
I think that if you put the major secret agencies from the intelligence community into this new department, it would just be too large and unwieldy. After all, the Pentagon today is so huge that everyone understands it's unmanageable. No person, I don't care how talented they are, has been able to go in there and really effectively manage the Department of Defense. So you can get too large, and I think that people wanted to avoid that sensibly. So they consolidated 22 agencies and with a budget of about $38 billion, which is less than the Department of Education, but it's still a hunk of money. And I think this is useful to consolidate these groups, and I think this proposal will pass. It's got a lot of support on both sides of the aisle. But again, I keep coming back to my main thesis, and that is the real problem is getting the other cluster of agencies, known as the intelligence community, 13 agencies, FBI, CIA, and 11 others, to work together. And their responsibility will be to feed information in to the new Homeland Defense Department so that that department can then react and protect us. So you see, Terry, the intelligence community is in the business of gathering information and providing insight to what might happen. That would then be passed along to Homeland Defense Department, which is responsible for actually throwing up the barriers to protect us.
So the CIA and the FBI aren't integrated into the Department of Homeland Defense, but they're still feeding information into it?
That's right. You could view the Homeland Defense Department that's been proposed as a client, if you will. And the FBI and the CIA will provide this client with, ideally, very good information about what the threats are. Then it'll be up to the Homeland Defense to protect us against those threats.
How much controversy is there about this proposed Department of Homeland Defense? A, controversy over whether it should be created or not, and B, whether it's well created.
I think there's a fair amount of controversy. After all, Ted Kennedy, the Democratic senator from Massachusetts, has said it's like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. I think that's a little harsh. I think it's a more useful proposal than that. But it does have a little bit of the feeling of being thrown together quickly and not fully thought out. But after all, that's the glory of our system of government. Now the Congress will have a close look at this, and there'll be plenty of hearings held, and there'll be amendments and modifications, and I think a stronger proposal will come out at the end.
What do you think this joint committee that's investigating what went wrong with intelligence agencies regarding September 11th, what do you think they're up against? You have some experience in this yourself.
Well, they're up against the time clock above all, and frankly, I think they're rushing to judgment. I've been rather disappointed at the notion of beginning public hearings this month of June because they only got started in February, and they fired their staff director in the middle of the process. And having been on a couple of these inquiries, I know it takes time to interview the people you need to talk to and get the documents you need. And I'm sure they have a good staff, and I'm sure they've been working hard. But you've got to sift through this information and make sense out of it. And then once you understand everything and you have some recommendations in mind, that's when you hold your public hearings. They're going to run into, I think, the problem of not being fully prepared to present their case persuasively. And, of course, at the same time, they're confronting an executive branch that's quite aggressive and preempting them by announcing solutions of its own. And I would imagine there's a little bit of stonewalling going on, too, because the executive branch always knows that these investigative committees have a limited amount of time, so they can stall them out.
What kind of changes would you like to see within the intelligence community?
The war against terrorism is very complex. There's no single answer. A new Department of Homeland Defense is not going to solve our problem. The United States is going to have to move forward across a broad front. We have to improve the coordination of these 13 intelligence agencies we've been talking about. We do need the consolidation of the 22 additional agencies that the Homeland Defense Department will bring about. But then we need a lot of other things as well. The jointness or interconnectedness of these computers in the government has got to be solved. I mean, our government is 30 years behind Silicon Valley in developing information technology. And it's outrageous that these computers don't even talk to one another so that information can be quickly shared. And then, above all, we have to overcome this problem of separateness, where agencies are involved in more in turf protection than they are in working together. And that's going to take presidential leadership, not just for an afternoon press conference, but on a steady weekly basis where George Bush brings these agency heads together and reminds them time and time again that if they can't share, if they can't cooperate together, then he'll find someone who will to take their place.
Locke Johnson is a professor of public and international affairs at the University of Georgia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.